You're in for a real treat. In this conversation, Mohammed Sheikh shares how he found the courage to start using the tools that he learned from his mentor, Hugh Comerford, even though he doubted that it would work at first. If you've been dealing with your own limiting beliefs about moving toward your goal and making a meaningful difference in the world, you will find pure gold in this conversation. At one point, Mohammed walks me through a heart math protocol that is an excellent litmus test for making big decisions in your life. I invite you to close your eyes and follow along during this part of the call to find answers to your own questions. Just a heads up, at one point you'll hear some very well-placed four-letter words, so you might want to cover your kids' ears when you know it's coming if you have little ones in the room, and you will know it's coming. Enjoy this episode. First of all, thank you so much for agreeing to do this. I've wanted to sit down and have a conversation with you for a long time, and I was so bummed when we didn't ever get to connect at HypnoThoughts last year.
Yes. So
I'm really happy that we get to do this. Will you just talk to me a little bit about your story? Tell me, I know that's where so many people start, but I'm genuinely curious about what got you started, what your history is, and where you are now.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I've actually been wanting to sit down with you too. I remember going through some of the messages on Facebook Messenger and us trying to connect in the previous HypnoThoughts that just never ended up happening. Right. So, you know, I'm really happy to be here, and I'm, you know, thank you for asking me. I guess, you know, it's really interesting. I like to tell people that I'm in this role by accident, right? I wasn't an individual that said, hey, it would be cool to become a hypnotist, right? Or I wasn't an individual that ever thought that I would actually be doing therapy, even though legally we're not allowed to use the word therapy, right? Because we don't do that at all, not at all. So my story is this. I think two things. One, I've always been curious from the youngest of ages that why is it that the same life event can happen to like two different people? And this really fascinated me. Now, how come that same life event can happen to one person and it's the thing that puts them in a downward spiral? And the exact same thing can happen to yet another person. And it's like, you know, I told the joke, I've said this so many times now, that it's the thing that turns them into like a TED Talk 30 years later, right? Is the catalyst for their own transformation and change. And I was always fascinated by psychology and not really psychology. I didn't think, you know, as a 10-year-old kid, I even knew what that word is. I think I was just interested in humans, in human experiences. And like, why is it that I'm good at some things that are so difficult and challenging for other people, but it comes like that for me. And at the same time, why is there so many things, other things that other people make seem so simple? And I struggle with this. So this sort of fascination, right? And but computer science and math was my jam, right? Like I was coding since I was 9 years old. I wrote my first program at age 9. And I was just watching my brother. And like, that's the whole field and life that I thought I was going to be getting myself into. At 15 years old, my computer science teacher actually introduced us to Chicken Soup for the Soul. And I got hooked. Right. I just read, everyone else was like rolling their eyes, like, but every class he started with like, you know, 5 minute story. And it did something for me just really, cause I think it really helped me answer that sort of deeper questions that I just intuitively always had. And I went out and got every single Chicken Soup for the Soul book. Like I even read Chicken Soup for the Woman's Soul. Okay. So imagine you've got a 15-year-old boy with access to empathy. Right. So that's interesting. You know, I was still very much, you know, more about video games. I'm almost 40. I'm still more about video games. Right. But it was interesting. And all of that came in handy because when I entered first year, having applied to university with any pick of school I wanted with like a 90s average, I faced something that I've never faced before, fear. Around writing exams and tests. I was bullied. I wasn't the cool kid, all that. But the thing that gave me my self-confidence and my self-worth was my academics, right? I was always the smart kid. I was always the kid that always came number one. I was always the kid people, and I loved helping. People would always come to me with, can you help me with my assignment? Can you help me with this? And I loved that. And so, you know, first year came and basically, long story short, I attempted to do first year 3 different times in 2 different schools And by the end of it, I was so just mentally and emotionally fatigued that even after I changed schools and I gave it one more shot, I was able to get my mark from, like, because I just couldn't write exams and tests. I was able to get myself to the point where I could at least write the exams and write the tests, and was getting, like, I think like a C, which I've never seen in my life, right? But I was passing, but I was just done. So I just quit. I dropped out completely and I entered the work field. And the only job you can get where there's money, because, you know, I got married at 23 by choice. That wasn't, you know, people ask, they say, it's not arranged. I'm like, no, this was actually my own thing. I wanted to say, I just wanted to have some stability in life. And I mean, and of course, you know, that's another love story. We're going to make a Bollywood movie out of it. She was actually my first crush. Right. Yeah. We're going on 15 years now. So, you know, I needed some stability. So I got a job in sales because that's the only place where there's money. And, you know, I bounced from different organizations and different small businesses, but I eventually landed like a proper corporate sales job. It was my first big company. They were like a $10 billion company, you know, 5,000 employees, mostly in America, right? Chicago is where their head office was, but they had about, they did about 500 mil in actually at that time it was only 200 mil in Canada, but maybe 200 employees. So, but for me, like coming from like 2-person, 5-person small business shops, right? So anyways, all of that happened and I'm working at this company. And I'm not performing because in my head, I'm basically still the guy that dropped out of school. I'm still the guy that, well, what am I going to amount to be? Because I come from, you know, whole culture and background and family line of professionals and academic achievements and all that sort of stuff. Right. And, you know, like I was good on the outside, right? Like I was able to, you know, have fun and go out and all of that. But I was truly, you know, just filled with nothing but self-doubt. And I used to have a lot of anger. I grew up actually having a lot of anger, right? And I like to show off this scar, especially when I work with clients that suffer with anger issues now. I mean, this is me putting off, I don't know if you can see that between my fingers.
Oh, I see it now. I saw it at the end.
Yeah. That's for me, like getting so pissed off once, putting a hole through a wall, right? Anyway, so all of this happened and the anger was because like I was this brilliant kid, you know, and yet I just can't seem to do something as simple as sell. So that is around the time that NLP found me. And it truly was that NLP found me. It was in the form initially of there was a guy who was an you know, we call them sheikhs, but they're basically like scholars of Islam. Like they've studied and they're academics and they're scholars. But the interesting thing about this guy, although he was like a Medina graduate and, you know, very much into the religion, and he was like kind of like an imam or a priest, but not really, not like he would teach. He's not the person who ran a church or something like that, right? But he was took a bunch of Tony Robbins classes when he was younger. And he combined the two things, and I really got, you know, connected with my religion at that time, because I wasn't necessarily practicing when I was younger. But the big thing for me was he exposed me to a different way of thinking. And it's like, this is all NLP, right? And then from there, a friend of mine introduced me to Hugh, right? And I've known Hugh since 2009. And 2009 is basically when I went from almost being fired at the sales company because of low performance to literally within the span of 12 months being top 10% income earners.
Wow.
And from like, I think tripled my income in a span of 12 months.
That's incredible. And because, this is Hugh Comerford.
Yeah, this is Hugh Comerford. Exactly. Yeah. That, you know, my initial NLP training with him was once a week, every week for 20 months. Wow. Right. So it was quite intense. So every week we would go back and I would work on stuff, right? You know, just with the fellow students, because you'd have to practice those things we're learning. And so you would pick real life situations. So I ended up just dealing with a lot of stuff that I was holding off in the pretense of doing class exercises. And it really transformed my entire life.
That is so incredible. I've observed some of what you've put out some content inside MMHA and done some trainings, and I am always so impressed with your background in NLP, your technical ability, and your, I can tell you have a strong foundation and a deep grasp. How much of that do you contribute to just modeling, being in the presence of Hugh so often and so frequently, and almost absorbing that by modeling him?
Yeah, I would say there's a good chunk. I know today I'm very different because I found kind of my own style and my own nature. But if you ever see me teaching a class and you see Hugh teaching a class, right, it is literally like you're watching a photocopy.
Amazing.
Right. I have modeled, you're absolutely correct. I have modeled so much from him because it wasn't just the 20 months. Then I took his, my master's training, which is another 21 days. And then I was a resource for him for two more rounds of 20 days each. And then I trained for him. I trained one of his classes for 2 years. So I spent up until about, I think 2015-ish, you know, I spent a solid 6 years, like almost every weekend or every other weekend with the guy.
Wow.
Yeah, I was really fortunate. Yeah.
Yeah. So for someone who is listening and thinking, you know, so much of what we've learned with NLP is the value of modeling someone who's doing it well. And I think sometimes when people are getting ready to start to practice things that they've learned, they're afraid they're going to be copying or imitating. So how would you tell that person to reconcile in their mind the idea of modeling a person who's doing it well and not thinking of it as inauthentic or copying or faking it till you make it?
Yeah, so that's a really good question, right? So, I mean, honestly, I don't think it's possible to not copy, mm-hmm. right? I mean, everything has an orange. I mean, if NLP in and of itself is nothing new. I mean, all Bandler and Grinder really did is they ripped off a bunch of people, right?
Yes.
You know, if I can say it like that, you know, not to take anything away, but I mean, they ripped it off, they modeled it, right? And then they kind of connected the dots in their own way. And I think that's always going to be us, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's flat out plagiarism, for example. Like one of the things that just annoys me is like when people take something like, you know, the 6-step reframe, just for an example, or, you know, it's the exact same thing, but they're just calling it now, you know, the Muhammad 6-step reframe and stuff like that. I mean, you know, at least have the courtesy to mention this was adopted from the original, right? Like give credit, but you know, that's all really semantics. I just think when we do our work, it's impossible, right? Because ultimately what we're paying for is us. We're paying for our time. We're paying for the human connection. You know, that's what we're charging for, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you were to look back at a snapshot of before you started working with Hugh, and then at the end of that year when you had tripled your income and had skyrocketed to the top 10%, can you maybe articulate a little bit of the mindset shift that you went through, the before and the after of what that metamorphosis looked like?
Yeah. And, you know, we're still telling the story as well, because I'm giving you some background. But as far as how I started doing this, there was a pivotal change. But to answer your question, I think the biggest thing that NLP gave me was a realization. Jason Silva says it best, reality is the stories that we tell ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that's what was happening with me, is it's not that I was lying to myself. And I think that's very important. It was true that I dropped out of school. It was true that I had fear. All of those things were true. But what I had allowed to happen is I had an amazing ability to focus razor sharp on only the things I did wrong. Mm. Right? Mm-hmm. The whole of Muhammad, which we teach this to our clients, you know, we are more than our thoughts, we are more than our beliefs, we are more than our behaviors. But for me, I was very much, Muhammad is the dropout, mm. right? And when I really look back today now, in those years from 19 to, 22, really, it was those 3 years. I actually also had a lot of fun. That's around the same time I got into magic, right? That's the same time that I started going out and just really having, fun, right? And, so there was actually a lot of good things going on in my life, but, my brain was deleting all of that and just focused on the stuff that I was doing wrong or the stuff that, where I fell down. And so my entire reality was basically made up of those stories. And that was the biggest real shift, is to recognize, wait a second, what about the Muhammad that's been coding since 9? What about the Muhammad that started up a business when he was in grade 5 and started up a school newspaper? What about this? What about that? Right? What about, I'm still more than all of that?
Right.
So that was really the first step. And then second was actually, as you said, learning actual tools on how to model human behavior. Because the truth is, while I had a desire and a fascination about sales, I had no idea what I was doing. But I used to sit right next to people who would be making over $100,000 a year. And we all got paid the exact same salary in this company. Everyone got paid $32,500, right? So I was able to go and model what they're doing, their strategies, the thoughts, the beliefs, everything that they do, and basically reproduce the results, which is what NLP is. So those two things together.
That's incredible. Now, you said there's more to your story. I don't want to interrupt you. I have a couple of questions, but I'd love to hear more of what brought you where you are today.
Yeah, so it's a bit of a funny story, actually. So the thing that really pivoted for me was, I think this was 2010, and I just finished, the NLP training. I'm still working corporate. I haven't quit corporate life yet. And I actually quit corporate life not to become a hypnotist. I quit corporate life to get away and just get autonomy over time. And, I started up an IT company. But I was getting a massage done, okay? Right? And I'm getting this massage done. And, this is someone that's in the same building. So I go to see her quite regularly. And she starts telling me that she's having panic attacks. And she thinks she has claustrophobia. Every time she gets into a public bus, it never used to happen before, but for the last 3 weeks, everything, as you and I now know, it's all panic attack textbook, it starts closing off. She finds it trouble to breathe, everything starts getting dark, all of the classic stuff. And I say to her, wow, that's horrible. And I just put it out there. I'm like, so I took this thing, NLP, Don't worry about what it is, but it really changed my life around, right? And I learned this thing called the fast phobia cure. And I'd be happy to run it on you. And she's like, you used to have panic attacks? I'm like, well, I don't think I ever had a panic attack, but I had some stuff, right? I'd be willing to do it. It only takes 10 minutes. And she's like, well, I don't have another client. At this point, I'm desperate because life's becoming really difficult. Right? I don't own a car. I have to rely on my dad, my boyfriend to drive me. They're not always around. So I run her through the exercise. We're in the movie theater. Big thing. This is the first time that I am actually ever doing anything outside the classroom. Okay. And I'm pretty sure I butchered the steps. It takes me 20 minutes to do the 10-minute phobia cure. And I look at her and I'm like, so how do you feel? And she just says, Muhammad, you're so sweet. Thank you. I really appreciate it. I don't really think that did anything, but I really appreciate you. Thank you so much. I'll figure it out. Maybe I'll figure this out. Thank you. So I'm like, no problem. Like I said, it's really helped me more for confidence and, communication and all of that, self-esteem. It's not like I'm a therapist or anything, right? So I leave the room, and I think I mentioned that the PhysioMed clinic, like the clinic she worked out of, is in the same office building as where my office was, the company I used to work for. I randomly bump into her in the hallway about 2 to 3 weeks later, and she comes running towards me and gives me the biggest hug, right? And I'm like, that's a little awkward because, do you treat all your clients like that, right? what's going on? She's like, I don't know what you did, Mohammed, but it worked. And I'm like, I honestly forgot. I'm like, what are you talking about? And she says, that thing, I couldn't get a ride. I was getting for late for work. I was worried because my boss is already, he gets it, but he, you know, I have to, it's my responsibility. And so I'm like, let me take the bus. And every single time, it's the exact same thing. I get in the bus and I still remember almost verbatim what she says. The feeling starts in my knees and it starts to go up and then I start choking. But this time it started in my knees. I got on the bus, it started in my knees. It started working its way up. And just before it hit my stomach, I was suddenly in the movie theater with you. And I saw myself, you know, having the panic attack. Because classic, you know, we're disassociating, you know, that's part of the process, right? I saw myself having the panic attack and she had the panic attack and I realized I'm fine. And I was breathing just normally. And then on the way back home after my shift, I had a ride, but I was so fascinated by what happened. I actually said, I think I'm good. And I took the bus home and this time nothing. It didn't even come in the knees. And for me, my words were, I don't swear a lot. I swear with purpose, but my legit, my words is like, holy fuck, this shit actually works. So that planted a seed. Hugh introduced me to Mike in January of 2013. And I would say Mike is the one who really coached and urged and motivated me to start working and teaching, right? And anyways, the rest is sort of history.
That story is so incredible. Can you put yourself back in that massage room and think about having the idea to talk to her? If you're like so many of us, you know, we have these tools, we've been through this training, but the idea of actually trying it seems so scary. Did you experience some of that in there? And if so, how did you talk yourself into actually working with her and suggesting, hey, I have this idea, shall we try it?
Yeah, you know, that's awesome. So two things. One, I'm going to admit to everyone that's watching, forget about going back 10 years and into the massage room. I still have that today. Okay. Whenever there's a new client of a new thing that I haven't tackled, there's still a part of me that's like, what are you getting yourself into, Mohammed? Right. And whenever I hear that feeling or I feel that feeling rather, that's like, this is exactly what I need to get into. So, you know, that always comes up. But yeah, I mean, I do remember, of course, there was a hesitation because it's like, you know, you don't want to make a fool of yourself, right? And, you know, like, it's kind of weird and awkward too, because like, I'm the client, she's the massage therapist. And, you know, it's just, it was a bit of a thing. And then it's like, you know, just put an offer out there. And, but I was just like, you know what? What's the worst that can happen? Mm-hmm. And I, you know, worst case scenario, she'll just say, no, I appreciate it. Right. And I think also having a background in sales, getting no a lot. Right. Yeah, and then of course, growing up, I wasn't, like I said, popular with the girls. So I got a lot of no's then, which is actually what led me to knowing I would be okay in sales, because I was already used to getting a lot of no's. So I think it's just a matter of, you just got to jump. You got to jump, and you know, it's never as bad. And she actually said yes. And you know the story. Yeah.
And then for you to go through the protocol with her, feel like you stumbled over some of your words, forgot some of the parts. And then at the end, she says it didn't work. What went through your head then that allowed you to, you know, not just be devastated?
Yeah, you know, I think for me, it was, to be honest, I didn't feel any rejection at all. And I'm gonna tell you why. I honestly think it's because I didn't expect it to work myself. Hmm. Right? The Mohammed that showed up at that point was basically the Mohammed that just holds the door open for people. You know, like, I just want to be nice. I just want to do something. Right. And I actually had zero expectation that it would actually work. It's very different now when I work with a client because, of course, I have an expectation. I know this is going to do something, right? I think I probably would fear more now, would feel it more now if something didn't work. But then it was just like, look, I'm just being nice. It's just whatever. And I framed it like that. I said, look, you want to try something? Look, I'm no therapist, but hey, it really helped me in my life to do with this. And the guy who teaches it swears by it.
Ooh.
Right? Yeah. So maybe now that I'm thinking backwards, I honestly have never thought of this. So this is a great question. I'm really kind of going back in time now. I think I also basically put all the ownership on Hugh. Right? Well, like, I can't fail. If anything, he taught it to me. He's the one that's going to fail. I don't know. Maybe that's what happened, right? Anything more I say, I think I'll be making it up at this point.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, such is the case with memory.
It's so cool, though, that, you know, sometimes I'll even teach people a big part of your success is just imagining it working. But it's so cool that we have these processes and these tools. And I've experienced the same thing where on the inside, I'm like, this is never going to work. And then a couple of weeks later, they come to me. One example is my sister. She had a diet soda addiction, like a severe diet soda addiction. And I walked her through an NLP process. She's kind of rolling her eyes the whole time and like kind of doing it, but not really. And she is repelled by diet soda now. She hasn't touched it in years. And it's incredible. And I think the best way to start realizing this stuff actually works is to start actually doing it. If you wait until you're confident, you're never going to start.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's so funny. I was having a conversation yesterday with just another MMHA member. We were just chatting, you know, shooting this stuff. And, you know, she told me about this feeling of, I guess, what's the marketing term? Imposter syndrome, right? That's the marketing right. term, right? I'm going to sell you a course on imposter syndrome. And you know, I'm like, so how do you deal with that? And she's like, well, I just feel like I need to do more trainings. Mm-hmm. And so I said to her, I think I'm going to tell you something which no one has told you before. And if you meet anyone else that's going to tell you this, I want you to introduce them to me because they're going to be my new best friend. And she's like, of course not. I was really paying attention, right? What are you going to tell me, Muhammad? She's like, what if I told you that taking more classes, not only is not useful, everyone says that. What if I told you that taking more classes is actually making it harder for you to get started?
And everyone who's listening to this right now know that Muhammad was talking to you.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
Absolutely, right? That is exactly it. Because, you know, I kind of look back in my thing, all I really knew was what Hugh taught me, mm-hmm. which, you know, I'm making it sound like I spent a bloody amount of time with the guy, right?
Right.
And then, you know, that's all I did. And, you know, Michael kicked. So then I started training with Mike and I learned a little bit about hypnosis. But to be honest, hypnosis didn't actually make it into my client work until maybe 2017. Before that, I was just doing all, even though I knew it, but I never did inductions. I never, you know, like I still don't do inductions, but it was just what I knew and I just had mastered it, and that's what I just kept on repeating, right? But the real feeling that we're looking for that allows us to feel that we're ready and we've arrived, it's never going to be in a classroom because the person you're doing an exercise with, they know the steps, right? And chances are they probably don't have a real problem. It's just, you know, it's never the same thing, right? Taking a class in karate is good to do the drills, but being in an actual fight, it's very different, right? And so we have to get out there and just do the work. And I mean, everything that I know, honestly, is because of what my clients have taught me.
I love this conversation because I feel like we're going right to so many people's insecurities. I did a survey a few months ago because I was going to do it. I call it silencing the imposter monster. And I surveyed people and said, why haven't you started? And so many people said the same thing. I'm afraid of copying so-and-so. Everything I want to do has already been done. I don't have anything new to say, or what if it doesn't work? So being able to talk about some of these things and realize that you have some of the same doubts. I know I have some of the same doubts. I think for me, being a little bit more visible and having people come to me and say that I want to do what you're doing, but ... helps me realize, okay, that voice in my head happens to everyone. And there's something that happens, I think, when we realize that it's okay to do it before you feel completely ready and before you feel completely confident, can be incredibly liberating.
Yeah. You know, growing up as a kid, all I ever wanted was a motorcycle. Mm. And there's a lot of things, that I wanted that I do want. But motorcycle was definitely one of the things. I remember every time we go to Pakistan, I try to get my cousins to teach me. I just never figure it out, right? And, 2014, all my buddies got motorcycles. It just happened, right? And 2013. Everyone got motorcycles. I'm like, oh, great, this is great. I'm going to get a motorcycle. But the most interesting thing happened. I was at a bed and breakfast with my wife up in about an hour from here. And the guy had this massive property and he had a dirt bike. And he's like, Mohammed, I'm going to teach you how to ride. I'm like, this is great. This is exactly what I wanted in my life, right? And while he's teaching me how to ride, I took a dive. I fell down. I mean, it was grass. I was going no more than 10 kilometers an hour, right? Probably 5, because it was just really silly. I actually threw myself down because I panicked. So it's not like I threw myself down and I twisted my arm. And I didn't realize, but I actually damaged my rotator cuff because of that. I was fine. I got right back up and I was able to ride again. But by the evening, I couldn't even lift my arm. And of course, I never went to see someone, but I'm good now. So this happened and it put fear in me. Hmm. Now, fast forward next year, 2014, and a bunch of buddies are, some of my closest friends are trying to get motorcycles. And I'm doing research on how safe is it to get a motorcycle in the city. And of course, my brain is like, this and that. And I'm on forums and reading sites of just all of the dangers of getting a motorcycle and everything. And, I love what you said about how amazing it is that our brain just tells us and has these processes and stories and stuff, just really to help us continue to cope. Right? That's all it is. And it's about safety. And my brain protected my ego and gave me a way out. And it gave me the story that, Mohammed, it's not that you don't know how to ride a motorcycle, or it's not that you don't know what you're doing. But the truth is that people in the city don't pay attention. If you were living in the country, then it would be a totally different story. But because you can't trust people in the city to watch out for motorcyclists, that is the reason that you shouldn't get a motorcycle. And so I had my story, I had everything. I felt really good about myself because I didn't feel like I failed. And I was like, yeah, no, I think I'm gonna sit this one out. And I think maybe a month went by and I said, wait a second, if I give into this, what else am I giving into that's going to generalize in my life? Because we know the way emotions and beliefs, all of this stuff always generalizes. Because this would be the first time in my life now that something scared me and I didn't go for it. And I actually became more afraid of giving into this, because what else would that then give me an excuse to not get into later in life? My wife was my first crush in Pakistan, right? And if you understand culture and, dating and all of that is not a thing, it's very taboo, right? But I was just like, to hell with it. And I started emailing her from here.
Wow.
Right? And it's like, no, like that's what I want, right? And so I was like, hell with this. I recognized. And I was like, wow, how brilliant are you, brain? You even like protected my ego and everything to give me the story. But no, this is the truth is I'm afraid. And this is exactly why I need to do it.
Mm-hmm. I feel like you just inspired so many people. I can feel myself just thinking of all the barriers that I've set up in my own life that I am going to find courage just because of that story. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I think that for me, when I think of where I was when I decided to start doing this work and where I am today, the biggest thing that has helped me move forward is a willingness to get outside my comfort zone and to start to recognize that voice that's making excuses and thinking of all the reasons you can't as what I call the imposter monster, and realize that that actually means it's going to be awesome, or maybe it's not going to be awesome, but you're going to learn something. And I recently gave a presentation, and at the end of the presentation, I was thinking, oh, I could have done this better and I could have done this better. And I thought, no, you know what? I did it. And I flipped it around and I just started saying, so many people never find the courage to get up and stand in front of a group of their peers and present, and just started telling, congratulating myself, even though there, you know, I could have done better. There's so much value just in doing it, whether you do it perfectly, whether they know that they aren't afraid of buses anymore as soon as you're done or not, you did it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think you'll really appreciate this. My first training class that I taught, because it beautifully captures everything that you're telling me, and this is so amazing that you did that research, you know, asking people like what's coming up. So there was a woman, someone that I've done some community work with, and we've become friends. And she's like, Muhammad, we want you to train us in NLP. And I'm like, that's amazing. Yes, it absolutely changed my life. Here's Hugh's information. Go sign up to his class. And she's like, no, we want you to train us. Right. And I'm like, well, I don't teach. And he's like, sure you do. Right. And you've talked about wanting to, so let's do it. And then I'm like, you know, but all I know is Hugh's stuff. And, you know, I mean, it's going to be plagiarism, like literally the exact same stuff. Right. And why don't you just go? And he's like, well, to be honest, his course is very intense. It's absolutely worth it. It's actually a bargain. Mm. Right. But it's also, you know, in the thousands of dollars, and but it's also 21 days. Right. So it's absolutely a bargain. Hugh, if you're listening to this, please raise your price. Right. So I can charge more. So I said, go to him. But she's like, no, you know, we don't have the 21 days. You know, that's a lot of money. We just want some little basic stuff, just some foundational stuff, and really want you to do it. It was her and one of her friends who was like a Reiki person. And I was just like, okay. So I had all of these things, all the reasons why I didn't want to do it. One of the biggest ones was I honestly felt I would be stepping on Hugh's toes. So I reached out to the guy. Right. And I said, look, I want to do this. And he's like, bro, go for it. He didn't say bro. He doesn't say bro, but he's like, Muhammad, go for it. Right. He's like, you know, you have my stuff, you know, teach it. You know, I would appreciate if you mentioned my name, of course. Actually, in the beginning of my manuals, I always have his and Mike's names. But, you know, go for it. Like, this is you, you know, absolutely. So he totally took that block away from me. And then I said, well, where am I going to get people and advertising? And she basically said, look, I'm going to take, you just have to show up. She gave me her basement. I charged $200 for a 10-week program, 9-week wow. program at that time, which is nothing, right? But this is the thing which all of my programs and all of my successes have followed this pattern. I said I was going to do it. People signed up. And then I said, oh, shit. And then I had to show up. And then I showed up and it finished. And I was like, oh, my God, I just did that. And it's been a rinse and repeat. Like, literally, that's, you know, like all of the things. And she put 8 people into her basement and I taught that course. And it was like, oh, my God. Yeah, like I can totally do this. Right?
Yes. That's fantastic. I do the same thing myself. I finally learned to stop waiting until I felt ready.
Yeah. Not to go down that rabbit hole, but I spent a few years volunteering in a mental health youth line. During my time there, I just realized how broken the system actually is. Mm-hmm. I had no idea. And I'm like, why will we get people to talk about their trauma when there's so many more effective ways where the person doesn't have to go through it again? Under the guise of being fixed and just to release it. I mean, it's just, it's a very different approach. And I mean, I think at the deepest level, my goal is I wish for the day that I don't actually even have to do this work, right? Because it's being actually offered by the systems that are supposed to be there to make us better, right?
Yes.
You know, we have a sick care system, not a healthcare system. But anyways, that's another rabbit hole. Let's go back to helping our friends.
Okay. Yes. I appreciate you briefly mentioning that. And earlier when you and I were chatting about the massage room, you said, if I say anything else, I'm going to be making it up. And I think that often happens when we force people to talk about their traumas over and over and over. They forget what really happened and it becomes even worse.
Yeah. Oh my God. Okay. I have to mention this. So I had a client of mine who's taken almost everything that I've offered, right? He's done a lot of great work and he's a really, really awesome dude. He's like crushing it. And he gives me a call and he says, "Hey, Mohammed, I want to run something by you." And I'm like, "What's up?" He says, "So my company is offering this new program where everyone is getting a free session with a counselor, right? And they'll match you up depending on, you know, if you want a man or a woman or background or whatever, right? And then if you want more sessions, it's going to be subsidized by the company. What do you think of that?" And I'm like, "Wow, that's really cool. I think that's great. But out of curiosity, what would be your issue? Like, what are you going to be talking about? Like, you know, what's the challenge?" And, you know, he says, "To be honest, Mohammed, I don't have any problems." Right? Like, I mean, we all have problems, right? But, you know, nothing that I actually need, you know, I want to work on. I'm like, "So then why do you want to sign up for that?" He's like, "Well, you know how the situation is, Mohammed. I just honestly don't have anyone else to talk to." Right? And I felt like, you know, I felt that obviously, and I understood. And it just reminded me of like, you know, how sometimes therapy becomes like paying for a friend. So, you know, the work that we do is very different than that. It's, you know, we're more on focused on the actual changing of things. And hopefully if we do our jobs right, they never see us again.
Right.
Right. But that was an interesting thing. And I think, you know, on the side, it gives us exposure to just how lonely the world has gotten in the world of we're all connected with thousands of people, but are we really connected? But I remember saying to him, to your point, was, "Look, the situation, the context of that conversation is you're there for a problem. And that's going to be understood by both parties. And really, you're going to go then find a problem. And because you're going to be talking about that pseudo problem, just because it gives you permission to have that context happen, that conversation, that feeling of human connection to begin with, right? You're going to turn something that's not into a problem into a pretty big problem. And every week you go back, this is going to be reinforcing and reinforcing and reinforcing. At least this way you get it. It's very different than the person who actually had a problem and then goes talks about their problem every week, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I love that you made that point. Earlier, you mentioned I'm kind of just doing this for my own gratification, and I
Yeah.
imagine someone else will enjoy listening to this. You had mentioned that you didn't really incorporate hypnosis into your sessions until a couple years after you had been doing this, and that you don't do formal inductions. And I love that because I don't really. Sometimes people will come to me and say, "I'm not very good at this induction. And what induction do you use?" And my induction is generally close your eyes, or I will have been bringing them through an NLP protocol, and then I'll just start talking to them in a trancey voice and give them an experience that they're expecting. But so much of what I do is NLP based. So just talk to me a little bit about how you've incorporated hypnosis in, and perhaps a little bit about why you don't do inductions.
Sure. So again, like everything, I think there's two answers to that or multiple answers, but I want to take a step back first. I honestly think that when we're talking about, I actually have a talk, it's on my website, it's available for free, which is around like the structure I follow for change work. But for me, I honestly believe that not, the protocols isn't what creates the change, right? Like literally any protocol would work, provided that the person you're working with is motivated enough that they actually want to change, right? They're at threshold. I love Mike's, you know, definition of threshold. You know, something's got to change. It's got to be me. It's got to be now. I love that. I use that. That's all, you know, and it's helped me quite a bit. So when you have people, I think the number one most important thing is really you're providing that energetic space. You're providing that human connection, right? This might very well be the first time that they were in the same room or video conference, the same thing. It doesn't matter if physical or not, where they were speaking with an individual that actually believed that they can be better or sees them. And that's what I said in my talk, that it's as if I have a time machine. And the reason I say time machine is because you can believe something, but that doesn't necessarily mean you know it. But if I had access to a time machine and I went in the future and I saw my client doing the change, now I know. And that's what I show up with. They're going to follow me.
Yes.
Right? They're going to follow me. No matter what, I could literally just sit there and say to them, you know, if you're waiting for someone to give you permission to finally go ahead and do it, I'll be that person. I'm giving you permission, but you already know it, don't you? And they'll be like, you're right.
Wow.
You know, that's all it is, right? So when we, I guess, kind of actually get that, it really does give us a lot more freedom from the protocols, and puts importance of actually having that human connection and being with the person. You know, it allows us to do that. Now, there's that aspect. The second aspect is, I'll be honest, while I practiced a lot of stuff of hypnosis in the class in the beginnings, I wasn't confident in it. Right? I was like, this is all great. You know, the person is going to go into trance. This person is paying me money. I am not going to risk hypnotizing them because I can get the change elsewhere anyways, right? So there was definitely a thing of that. I didn't want to. And then the third thing is, I guess I also realized that, you know, hypnosis, who says you have to even have your eyes closed in order to be hypnotized, right? So there's kind of like, you put all of those things together, maybe in that order, right? Which is why, yeah, I mean, it's not necessary.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I don't think I follow a formal protocol ever in any of my actual sessions.
I know I did when I first started. You yes. want that script.
Yes,
you want
yes, that yes, structure. Yes, yes.
And then
yes,
you start yes. to kind of understand the concepts underneath and what's really working. And I fully agree with you. When you see the person fixed while they're sitting in your chair, while they're sitting on your Zoom session, and you yeah. imagine them lighting up and saying thank you and experiencing the change, everything else kind of falls into place. And it's like your unconscious knows what to say at the right time. And if you say the wrong thing, it's okay. And
right. Yet there's other things where I think one thing I was kind of mentally preparing for this call before, I think one bit of advice that Dr. David Murphy, who's also part of MMHA, gave me, it was just a conversation. He didn't really give this to me as advice. We were just talking, you know, something more I extracted from from the conversation, just pure wisdom. The amount of social and emotional support that is in a client's life, I actually use that now as a baseline on who I say yes to and no to.
Interesting.
Right. So if a person is coming with some very, very deep, depressive, like uncharted, dark stuff, but they've got family and they've got friends and they've got people in their lives, they're just really struggling and they just feel like they can't talk to them, that I will take them on. Right. Because that I know as part of our wellness is, you know, we need to have that, you know, if you've ever seen that YouTube video, the rat cage or whatever it's called, like the rat is put into two different cages trying to wean them off cocaine. One is like a paradise cage for a rat, or, you know, equivalent to paradise. And in the paradise cage, because of all, you know, everything is good, the rat actually chooses water over cocaine. Whereas a cage, I'll send it to you. Maybe you can
do
it.
Yeah, I'm intrigued.
It's really, really cool. I mean, just environment, it just talks about why so many people that were vets during the World Wars, where when they came back and they went, the individuals that went back to happy homes and happy families, they actually didn't have PTSD.
I've heard that. Yeah.
Right. And this is the experiment that was done. So I will take on those clients, right? I will, you know, assume that risk. But if there's individuals, and especially if we're talking about, you know, some real, you know, actual psychiatric disorders, I will draw the line, especially if there is no emotional support or family support systems that exist, because that's not what I offer, right? I mean, you know, like my thing is change, and they're not going to have the ability to kind of keep the momentum. So,
yeah. I have a question, and I might edit this out if depending where it goes, but I just, for my own self, I'm intrigued by, there's a part of me that thinks, even in situations like this, what if it was a massage therapy room kind of scenario where we say, let's just see what we can do in a session or two, or go into it with really low expectations and just see if you can make a difference. What, I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I think paramount is safety, right? I mean, it's what we're talking about. So, you know, in that context, I mean, yes, she's having panic attacks, but it's not self-harm.
So in the context of someone who is perhaps at risk, physical risk, that makes sense.
Yeah, right. Yeah. This is, you know, and I think this has to do with a lot of the exposure that I had working in that youth line, volunteering in that youth line.
Okay.
Right. It gave me a lot of appreciation, right? And also surrounding myself with the likes of, you know, Dr. David Murphy, with the likes of Adam Stein, who goes by Jester Eureka, right? Okay. You know, when you have these conversations with these individuals and they tell you stories, it's like, you know, it's important for us to kind of realize, but I mean, safe territory is performance stuff. Right. You know, like the generative change, go nuts.
Yeah.
You know, go nuts, right? When it comes to depression and anxieties, I will say, you know, there actually is a pretty large, what's the word I'm looking for? Distinction between someone that has a disorder and someone that has just been through depressive life situations.
Right.
And a lot of the work there is educating our clients that you don't have a disorder or you don't have depression or anxiety because, like, that's your problem, right? Because they start identifying with it. But rather, these are actual life situations that have happened, right? And these are the symptoms. This is the side effect, right? And so this is the sort of stuff. But if someone comes to me and they're doing things that, you know, like, there's just nothing that makes sense from a life situation, then I personally will draw the line there, because I'm like, okay, I think we need, you know, or at least work with their doctor or something like that. Here's a good, clear answer. Listen to your heart, because the heart will always guide you, right? If it's the brain saying, don't do this, that's just survival and that's just fear, and don't listen to your head. But when you get past the, you know, the noise that our brain makes, and we listen to the heart, if the heart is saying, stay away from this, then stay away from it.
Okay.
A lot of the fear, imposter syndrome, am I good enough? I need one more class. All of that stuff is not from the heart, right? That's all this thing just running, trying to keep you safe.
If you're doing okay on time, I would love to unpack that. And I feel like you are the perfect person, because I know you have a background in heart math and NLP. So you can tell a person who says, I don't know how to listen to my heart, or I'm not intuitive, or I don't know, I'm not sure if it's my gut or my imposter monster. How would you help a person know when it's their heart?
How about I answer that by showing you?
I would love it.
Okay. You don't actually have to tell me what, but can you think of something, perhaps a challenge or something creative? Maybe there's a product you want to launch or create. Maybe there's an obstacle. Maybe there's a tricky family, you know, political situation you got to navigate through, but something that you could just really use some insight.
Yes, I can think of something.
You got something, one thing, you know, because I said so much. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like a decision that in my business, do I do this or do I do this or do I try to do both?
Okay. All right. So the first step, and we're not going to do the first step, but the first step is you basically take a piece of paper and you write down everything that you can about, you know, pros and cons or whatever, or what do you need to take account? Like, just do a brain dump effectively.
Okay.
Right.
And I've actually done this. So.
And that's why I'm skipping it, because chances are you've already gone through this mental exercise, right? Whether you've actually wrote it down or not. Because we're always doing mental exercises in our head, aren't we? Yes. Okay. So go ahead and close your eyes. And focus all of your attention and all of your awareness on your heart. Breathing a little slower and deeper than usual. And just imagine that you can actually breathe into and out of your heart. Breathing a little slower and deeper than usual. If it's comfortable for you, 5 seconds in. And 5 seconds out. And now make a sincere attempt in activating a renewing emotion such as love, care, gratitude, or appreciation for someone or something in your life. And hold that emotion in your heart. And from this more coherent, grounded place of your heart, allow your heart's intelligence, your intuition, your wisdom to give you additional feedback, perhaps more perspective into this situation, whatever it may be. And quietly listen to the subtle communications, because the heart whispers. And whenever you're good, you can open your eyes, take as much time as you need. And when you open your eyes, commit to new insights and new perspectives and turning it into action.
That was really awesome.
Right?
Yes. I got an unexpected answer. Wow, that was really awesome.
Yeah. Do you want to, you know, without getting into the details, of course, but do you want to, you know, sort of unpack that for folks, like just what that was?
So I'm not sure how to unpack it without getting into details. So I'm happy to get it. So I've been trying to decide, because so many people have been engaging in this imposter monster stuff and really wanting tools to get out of their comfort zone and move forward. And I'm excited. I'm loving doing these trainings. And at the same time, I have a weight loss program where I do weekly calls. I'm super engaged and invested, and it's incredibly gratifying, but I'm trying to decide if I need to choose one niche or the other. And when I come at it from a place of compassion and I think about the people that I've impacted doing both of these, I feel like I want to continue in both. And that doesn't, I think if I would think of that logically, I wouldn't have chosen that option. But when I do it from the heart, I feel like I can't not.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm with you. You know, as also an individual that has began educating himself on digital marketing and stuff, I know how lucrative it is to build a course and then just make my life all about selling it. Right. But I also know the statistics are, while there are individuals, and power to you, but the statistics are most people who buy an online course don't even start it.
Right.
Guilty. Right.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Me too.
And we're all, and the ones that do start it, most people don't actually finish it. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, you know, when I come from a place of heart, I'm like, yeah, you know, it's not as scalable. It's not as this, it's not as that, you know, but live training, you know, that's my jam.
I agree with you. I agree. And I've tried both ways. And for me, I love the idea of making a good income, but I am determined to actually make a difference in people's lives. And I think when I build a community and I have this support and these back and forth interactions and weekly engagement, people have so much more success. And so I'm to the point now where I'm not even really looking at just hand somebody a course and say, do this. You have to show them how to build the habits to actually execute. And that's another thing that stood out to me in our conversation is you've taken these trainings, but you've actually implemented the tools and you've actually taken them on in your own life. Can you think of what has equipped you to do that? What has given you the ability to actually take action?
Yeah, I'm going to answer that question. And before I do, what I just led you through was a heart math technique called freeze frame.
Okay.
And what we did there is effectively, because of the heart-brain communication through the autonomic nervous system, what I didn't know prior to getting certified as a trainer with them is that while the brain sends information down to the heart, it's really nothing more than regulating blood pressure. Mm. The heart sends information up to the brain. In fact, the heart sends more information. It's 80-20 up. And when we access emotional states such as compassion or love or appreciation or gratitude, what that does is, one, it actually releases DHEA, which is a vitality hormone. It's the opposite of cortisol. It changes our heart rhythms on a beat-to-beat basis, which synchronizes our parasympathetic and our sympathetic branches. And it sends a very different neural signal to the brain. So it actually opens up our brain. And through the research they've done, they found that even before the unconscious knows, I mean, now we're getting into semantics here, because really, what is the unconscious? It's just a model, right? But before the mind knows, the heart actually is already showing, and they've actually been able to measure this.
Wow.
Right? And so intuition, being connected to that field, which is measurable now, it's no longer woo-woo.
Right.
Thoughts and ideas, someone's already figured it out. It's in there. Mm-hmm. Right? That knowing that we have, we're having our day, and then suddenly we start thinking of someone we haven't thought of for like 15 years. I was like, why the hell are we thinking about them? And then of course, now when that happens, I'm just so now aware of it that I'm just like, okay, when are they going to call me? Like 10 minutes later, they call me.
Right.
Right. Cause like, there's no other reason. Right.
Yeah.
But it's kind of cool, when that happens, and it just continues to happen. So that happens from the place of the heart. So what we're doing is we're shifting coherence. If we were to measure it using HRV, you would see your HRV rhythms actually become aligned. And what that does is it opens us up to the field, and it also opens up and boosts our mental performance as well. So we get out from that fear place and we get into, okay, what is actually important?
Mm-hmm.
Right? What's actually going on? And so, people do mind mapping, which is a great, I do mind mapping all the time. And now I teach, after you're done the mind map, do a heart map. Right? And that's a heart map term as well. We shift into coherence, we activate appreciation, compassion, love, gratitude. And from that place, we review the situation, and little bits of pieces always come out. It's like, oh yes, of course. Why was I, this is ultimately what's most important.
Yeah.
Right. So to answer your question about, obviously, my faith has had a huge impact on me. Right. A lot of my character, a lot of everything is ultimately it's modeling, what we know about, like the prophet, modeling all of the prophets, modeling Jesus, modeling Abraham, from the stories, like that's been a very important thing for me. And one of the things that, the companions of the past memorizing the Quran, you know, like the holy book for Muslims, is like a big deal.
Uh-huh.
Right? And in today's culture, parents get, you know, their children to try to memorize it, right? But it's a really, really interesting dichotomy now, because parents are more concerned with being able to say, oh, my kid has memorized the Quran, which is the complete opposite, you know? And they're in such a rush, but most of us aren't Arabic speakers. I mean, I don't speak Arabic. So, you know, I can memorize, and I have memorized bits and pieces of the Quran, like most Muslims. But do I know its meaning, you know? When you look at the companions of the past, they would say, and these are people that were Arabic speaking, they would say, we would not memorize the next verse of the Quran until we have embodied the verse we're memorizing now.
Wow.
Right? Mm-hmm. We would not go on to learn the next thing until we have it in the muscle.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think it's Grinder's line, knowledge is only rumor until it's in the muscle. So what we have, and this is where, why I get, you know, I guess this is the place I'm coming from when I say to my friends, taking more courses is actually harming you.
Yes.
Is because, I mean, yes, we need a foundation, okay? You know, but there's a point. Because now we're just filling our heads with information. And the reality is depending on the teacher, they're going to have a different approach.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just going to confuse the hell out of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Everything we, if you know, for, most of our friends are a part of MMHA. I mean, I have learned so much from Melissa Tears, from James Tripp, yes. from Carl, and from, you know, like David Snyder, just like all the people that, you know, I met at HypnoThoughts.
Mm-hmm.
But I had first really embodied everything I got from Hugh. Then I embodied everything I got from Mike. And then I went and I embodied. I remember I made 1 year, the year of Melissa Tears. Everything she had, I just did that and only that. And for that entire year, it's actually going to be a funny thing to imagine. I literally was a brown male Melissa Tears.
I love it. I love it.
And then I was James Tripp for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And all I was telling my clients was everything I learned from him. You know, and this is sort of like that embodying is because, look, you know, there's different approaches, but that's how you truly learn. That's how you turn information into skill.
Yes.
With knowledge in the middle.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow, Mohammed, this has been so amazing. I'm honestly, if no one else listens to this, I have gotten so much value from this.
I had so much fun myself.
Oh, this is just awesome. Yeah. I can't wait to go back through and take notes. And for anyone listening, I'll put links to everything you've mentioned. You will give me links to the trainings that you have available.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, and I'll put in there the heart math and James Tripp and Melissa Tears and all that for anyone that's listening and wants to know more. Really quickly, before we go, will you just talk to me a little bit, well, talk to my audience a little bit more about MMHA, because I am so passionate about directing people to Mike, especially people who are new to hypnosis and don't already have all these trainings. I am so grateful that I got my foundation with him. So will you just talk to me a little bit about the impact MMHA has had on your life? And for those listening, MMHA stands for Mike Mandel Hypnosis Academy.
Yeah, I mean, where do I sort of kind of begin? So from a place of learning hypnosis, I mean, the guy's been doing hypnosis since what, he was age 12 and he's in his 60s now. So the guy, he knows a few things, right? But I think what I appreciate most, and this is what I look for from the people that I call friends, is that for Mike, it isn't about Mike, right? You know, it's not about him. It's about hypnosis. It's about the love. It's about transformation, yes, right? Yeah. I mean, I think one of the biggest things I got from him is a recognition. You know, he always talks about, you know, you're not supposed to eat the buffet. That there's all these models, and that's all it is just a model, right? You know, and human transformation, human potential, and just who we can be, that connection that trumps everything, mm-hmm. right? You know, also to just recognize, you know, like, the number of times that he's admitted, I don't know what's possible. I'm still learning, you know, his whole frame on, you know, life should be effortless, fun, and vaguely annoying to other, like, there's just like, just so much. And that's the thing, you know, like, notice how I'm not even talking about hypnosis, really.
Right.
And Chris, the amount of support and motivation that I've got from him, right, is absolutely great. I mean, I think that's what it is. They're two of the most genuine individuals,
yes. right?
They truly care. And I think that's the most thing, that they actually truly, truly care. And I know for me, you know, Mike, like I've got Mike, you know, like I can ping him anytime and he'll always respond. And, you know, like, I just love that.
I fully agree. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's it. And, you know, okay. And if you want to learn hypnosis, they have a kick-ass training. An amazing community that is very giving.
Yes.
Right. And it's actually about, let's see how far we can go and making this world, you know, a better place and making ourselves better and growing, because that's what it's all about. Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I had the same takeaway when I went and trained. I went through the online academy, and when I went to Toronto and met Mike and Chris, I was just, in fact, I first saw them in Vegas, and I remember when Mike walked in the room, he walked past me, and it's almost like you could feel the love coming off of that man. And I realized he truly, his bottom line is that he wants to make an impact in this world, and he wants to help people. And I'm so grateful that I found those men.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, Mohammed, is there anything before we wrap up, anything that I haven't asked that is important, or anything that you would say to a person who is wanting to move forward? Any advice you'd like to leave?
Yeah, make yourself your own client and be kind. Mm. And just do it.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much. I'm grateful for you, and I'm grateful that we've connected in this way and that my audience has had a chance to hear your wisdom, and I wish you an amazing day.
Thank you so much for setting this up. I love doing this stuff, and you know, it was really good to talk about some of these things too and unpack. So
I hope you loved this episode. Look at the notes below to find links to where you can learn more about Mohammed or the various things that we mentioned during the show. Have an amazing day.